Hey,
Hi.
how are you?
Sleepy but good.
Same. He was eating a cheese Danish.
Hi, Tyler.
Claire says hi.
Hey, Blair.
Bye, Lynx.
Bye.
Panda
Oh, it's so cute. He's so
Lynx.
fluffy.
You ever seen a panda like that?
I got you. Bye bye. I don't know why he's
I had
sticking
not seen a
out.
panda like
That
that.
is the craziest panda I've ever seen.
Ever seen. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm Blair. What are you doing?
And I'm Kirsten, and we are
Mediocre
Mediocre Content.
Content.
I was gonna be like the with my arms.
Yeah, you're slowly raising your arms. I'm like, what's happening? Is she levitating her cat over there? What's going on?
Just levitating myself. I'm ascending into the realm of mediocrity. I'm actually very good at
Good.
it. Yes.
I love that for you.
And basically, in my head, I was playing the Dune song. You know the one.
I think about that often.
If you don't know what reference that is, it's not actually to Dune 2, it's actually to a stream we had, so please feel free to go
Yeah,
check
watch
it
me
out.
cry laughing on
I'm
the internet.
pretty sure we named it Giddy Up, so
Yeah.
it's on YouTube or the VOD if it's still up on Twitch. Anyway, that's what's going on in my head.
That's what's going on around the country. Here's what's happening in your neck of the woods.
Yes, now we're newscasters. This is the profession we are now claiming.
Specifically, Al Roker from the Today Show.
Yes, exactly. Well, he's an icon. How could
He
you
is an
not?
icon.
He's an
That's right.
icon.
Yeah.
Anyway, I am ascending, but not into the realm of Dune 2. We'll be ascending to space today, but that's a different story for a later in the pod, so.
Yes. So, as always, we have no idea what we're talking about. We're
We're
just two
doing.
idiots on the internet. Here we are.
True.
So with that being said, take what you hear today with a grain of salt. We love you guys and we want you to tell us if we're being stupid or wrong, which is frequently.
Actually,
So
don't tell the stupid part. You would be here all day.
that's true. We don't want you to waste your time.
Facts.
But we are going to talk about some fun things that you may not know about already. And we encourage you to research along with us, comment along, see, tell us how you feel about it. And yeah, it's
Yeah.
going to be a good, it's going to be a good pod. We're
I think
setting good
so.
vibes. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And you are setting good vibes with the good news today, which is also super amazing.
What a fabulous transition you just
Thank
did.
you
That was
so
amazing.
much.
Oh my God. All right. So a redheaded Brit named Ross Cook claims he is the first person ever to run across the entire length of Africa after crossing the finish line in Tunisia.
Dude.
I know.
That's insane.
The feat was immense, filled with danger. And when the self-styled hardest geezer, quote, arrived at the shores of the Mediterranean, he had run just over 385 marathons in 352 days in a total of over 10,000 miles.
That is less than a year.
That is running back and forth across the United States quite a few times, like more than Forrest
Oh,
Gump did in the movie.
that's insane.
I know.
Wow.
Also, I'm curious, like, what he ate and stuff. That's wild.
Also, no offense to runners out there, feel free to let us know. Usually, after a certain amount of time, you also have to crap really bad.
I mean, yeah, I guess he wasn't doing it for time, so he could just take his time, you
Yeah,
know?
I guess so.
More importantly, as Cook sees it, his inspirational accomplishment has raised over 650,000, close to $1 million, or 650,000 euros, excuse me, close to $1 million for a selection of charities. His route crossed 16 countries, deserts, rainforests, and mountains, and saw him get entangled in visa issues, muggings, sandstorms, injuries, sickness, and snowstorms.
I'm sorry, who is mugging this man? That's so rude.
I mean, he's a redhead in Africa.
Yeah, stop that.
I don't know. He probably sticks out a little though.
You think?
Yeah, maybe he got mugged by like an elephant or something.
So rude.
I know. It started in South Africa's remote southern town of La Agujas, I think.
Sure.
And landed him on a Tunisian beach with strawberry daiquiri in his hand. So
that's a great way.
Well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
BBC reports that his route started in South Africa and was followed by Namibia, Angola, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Republic of the Congo, Cameroon, Nigeria, Benin, Togo, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Guinea, Senegal, Mauritania, Algeria, and Tunisia.
That's a list.
His first 60 marathons went off without a hitch when he started in April 2023, but it was in Angola that he and his team were robbed at gunpoint with money, passports, and phones all stolen.
Oh, no.
The next major setback occurred in Cameroon, where he was constantly battling food poisoning. I know this doesn't sound like good news, you guys, but hang in there. After crossing Nigeria to Benin, he felt like a shell of himself, but by that point he had run something like 210 marathons.
Minor.
Reaching the very unique country of Mauritania. On day 267, people were endlessly stopping on the roads to offer water and supplies, but then unable to transit to the vast Algerian Sahara because of visa difficulties, he needed help of the British government to intervene on his behalf. That would have been a fitting last obstacle to overcome, but the Sahara buffeted him with both sandstorms and snowstorms in the same period, because apparently the Sahara can't make up its mind.
Good grief.
On the final day, his last 44 kilometers to the finish line were characterized by a gang of inspired runners who had flown out for the occasion.
That is,
and they
so
were
cute.
Able to finish like in a group.
That is adorable. How awful. First of all, how do you even come back from, I no longer have a passport.
Right.
In a foreign country.
I know.
That's horrifying.
And he's just out there to run. It's
right.
Not like
he just wants to run. Know,
right.
Yeah. I mean, kudos to him. I never want to run anywhere at any time. But to purposefully, I bet it's gorgeous in some of those areas to see all the different terrains and all the different countries and all the beautiful people. Yeah. But that's quite a feat in less than a year.
I know.
Wow. That's amazing. Ain't gonna catch me doing that, though.
No. Nope. It gives a whole new meaning to Run, Forest, Run. You know what I mean?
Exactly. What was his name again? Ross Run.
His name is Ross Cook.
Oh, that's great. Well, that is
certainly
good news
to him.
Yeah. Be happy it's over.
And he made it out alive. That's the other thing.
Right. I wish they had at the end. And he is now safely back in Britain. That's a lot of money to recoup, too. That's expensive to replace a lot of those documents.
Yeah.
Oof. Yeah. Well, I say that with only America in mind. I don't know how difficult it is.
Yeah,
in, like,
I don't know either.
Europe,
and I guess he like eventually was able to get the visa situation under control.
Sorted. Yeah, that's good. Good for you, Ross. Congrats.
Yeah. Applause.
Woo. So, with that, I realized. Okay. Yes. How do I? All right. So. In addition to those beautiful accomplishments by Ross, we actually accomplished something that I find to be very exciting and wonderful when we did our solar series and got through all of the planets, including the sun, and talked about all the magnificent things that make up our cute little solar system. That's great. What I failed to do was talk about how to frickin' get there, which is great. Mm-hmm. You would think that would kind of be included. Mm-hmm. And so I am here to remedy that today. And so today is a continuing episode of our solar series. And instead of focusing on planets or wormholes or galaxies and stars and stuff, we're going to be talking about the history of the space shuttle, what it's made of, and the difference between what you think is a space shuttle and what a space shuttle actually is. And that's gonna round it out until I think of something else spacey to talk about, which there's an infinite number of things. So
I love that for us.
Yeah, aren't it? Buckle up. So there are a couple of different parts that we're going to be talking about. We'll start with the basics. You probably have seen rockets go to space. You've probably seen a space shuttle go to space. You've probably seen probes or satellites or different mechanisms shot into the stratosphere, and all that's wonderful. But this one in particular, the shuttle itself, is made up of the orbiter, the main engine, the external tank, and what is called the solid rocket booster. It's very exciting, it's very wonderful, and I also encourage you to please take a look at the link that we provide in the subscription. All this information, as per our previous series, is straight from NASA, and they have a beautiful graphic that will actually point out all of those parts on the space shuttle and label them for you and talk about them in more detail, because as usual, this is just like a glance over, as we do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, let's begin with NASA's shuttle fleet information.
Yay.
So NASA's shuttle fleet achieved numerous firsts and opened up space to more people than ever before during the space shuttle program's 30 years of missions. There have been 135 missions flown and 852 shuttle flyers, which are the astronauts. In the early morning hours of April 12, 1981, NASA launched its first space transportation system, or space shuttle, carrying astronauts John Young and Robert Crippen into orbit. Mission commander John Young had already flown in space four times, including a moonwalk in 1972, and Bob Crippen, who was, I know, right? The pilot was a Navy test pilot who would go on to command three future shuttle missions, but nothing either man had done or would do was quite like this, meaning the first real space shuttle launch.
Okay. Can you hear the dog barking? In the background of mine. Okay, good.
No.
Her name is Bella. She's a corgi. Shout out,
Hi,
Bella.
Hi, Bella.
But she is barking so loud.
Anyway. She's having a blast. So on the spring morning in April, just 20 years to the day since Russian Yuri Gagarin became the first human in space in general, which is also quite an accomplishment, all of that was yet to come. America had not launched a human into space in 6 years, and to that point, every crewed space flight had followed the same basic design. You put a capsule on top of a rocket, strap in the crew, fire up the engines, and off you go. After the mission, only the crew capsule, which wasn't reused, would return from the old version. And we'll talk about that importance at the end. So we'll come back to that. Put a little pin.
I'm excited.
It.
I'm ready.
Yeah. So shuttle basics. What do you need to know about these things? The reason this was so miraculous is because, as I mentioned, the rocket version was not reusable. Once that thing was in space and the crew got out there and then returned, it's scrapped. There's nothing else that they can use from it. The difference between that version and the space shuttle is that the space shuttle was the world's first reusable spacecraft and the first spacecraft in history that can carry large satellites both to and from orbit. That's massive.
Mm-hmm.
The shuttle launches like a rocket would, like you've seen on television, and maneuvers in Earth's orbit like a spacecraft and lands like an airplane, super helpful. And each of the three space shuttle orbiters now in operation, which include the Discovery, Atlantis, and Endeavour, all of which we'll talk about later, are designed to fly at least, at minimum, 100 missions.
Okay.
So that's equivalent of 300 missions we have available to us in this moment.
That's cool. I like that.
That's great. And so far, altogether, they have flown a combined total of less than 1/4 of that. So even better.
Yeah.
And also just kind of mentioning, I think it was last week or the week before, we also talked about the fact that they're trying to put up a gas station in space, basically.
Right. Yeah.
So that would even further the longevity because then they could just stay out there. And again, that wear and tear of entering and exiting the atmosphere is causing less pressure on the shuttle.
I'm just going to put in for the obligatory all we want is free healthcare in this country. That's all we want. We
don't need a space shuttle gas station.
I'm just
what about my hover car?
For those, I mean, space exploration is very important.
Sure.
It has its place, but all we want is healthcare. That's all I'm saying. And maybe a bullet train. That's all.
That would be kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd be down for a bullet train.
Anyways, continue.
Fair enough. So Columbia was the first space shuttle orbiter to be delivered to NASA's Kennedy Space Center. And that was in March of 1979. The Columbia and the STS-107 crew, which is just what they just named the crew that, were lost, unfortunately, in February 1, 2003, during a re-entry. The Orbiter Challenger was delivered to KSC in July 1982 and was destroyed in an explosion during ascent in January 1986, which I think we're all familiar with for the most part. Yeah. If you're not, look it up. It's sad, but it's good knowledge to have because despite all of that, we also learned a lot between those. And, you know, as sad as it is, it's important information so we can build the new ones to be better.
If you're not old like us, you may not know
Just look it up. Just take a look. And Discovery was delivered in November 1983. Atlantis was delivered 1987. And Endeavour was built as a replacement following the Challenger accident and was delivered to Florida May 1991. An early space shuttle orbiter, the Enterprise, never flew in space, but was used for approach and landing tests at the Dryden Flight Research Center and several launch pad studies in the late 1970s, which also is where we gathered a lot of our information about space travel, what improvements we needed, etc. And then the space shuttle consists of those major components. So again, we've got the orbiter, that's what the crew is in. We have the large external tank, which obviously holds the fuel for the main engines. There are two solid rocket boosters, which provide most of the lift for the shuttle during the first 2 minutes of flight. And then all of the components are, like I said, reused, minus the external fuel tank that burns up in the atmosphere after each launch. So that is the part that will continuously be replaced.
Yep.
So here is information on shuttle stats as a whole. So we're talking about like length, weight, etc. The shuttle itself is about 184 feet long, and the orbiter, which again is what houses the crew, is about 122 feet long. It has a height, the orbiter, on the runway of about 57 feet, a wingspan of 78 feet, and a liftoff weight of 4.5 million pounds. Now, the reason that that's important to note is because like an airplane and you have to have the thrust that gets you up, you're taking all of that weight and picking it up against gravity into the sky. So a weight at rest is different than your weight pushing against gravity into the atmosphere and outside into the stratosphere. So just wanted to point that out. The orbit, which is the distance from Earth, they can go all the way out to about 386 statute miles. I don't really know what that universe of measurement is. Don't know that either. But that unit of measurement is, it probably said, I didn't look at it. Blair's looking it up live. And then its velocity is about 17,000 miles per hour. But of course, that varies depending on payloads and on board consumables.
Okay. So a statute mile is a unit of linear measure equal to 1,760 yards or 1.6 kilometers.
Thank you, Blaya.
You're welcome.
Perfect. So, little bit of extra information here. The longest the shuttle has ever stayed in orbit, because again, they can just go out there and hang out, on any single mission is just about 17.5 days. And that was on mission STS-80 in November of 1996. Oh. And right. So pretty recently. Yeah. I say pretty recent. We were born in the 90s, so it's fine. Normally, missions may be planned anywhere from 5 to 16 days in duration. The smallest crew ever to fly on the shuttle numbered 2 people on the first few missions, because you got to be careful. The largest crew number was 8, and normally crews may range in size from 5 to 7 people today. The shuttle is designed to reach orbits ranging from that 185 to 643 kilometers, which is that statute miles we just talked about. And then the shuttle has the most reliable launch record of any rocket that's currently in operation. So since 1981, it has boosted more than 1.36 million kilograms of cargo into orbit, which is about 3 million pounds, and more than 600 crew members have flown on its missions. Although it has been in operation for almost 20 years, the shuttle has continually evolved and is significantly different today than when it first was launched. Obviously, we've had a couple of trial and errors as well along the way, which helps out with longevity and information, as we've said.
Yeah.
NASA has made literally thousands of major and minor modifications to the original design, which has made it safer, significantly more reliable, and capable. So since 1992 alone, NASA has made engine and system improvements that are estimated to have tripled the safety of flying the space shuttle, and the number of problems experienced while in flight has decreased by 70%, which is pretty high statistically.
Yeah, that's really good.
I mean, if you get anything over like 20, 30%, that's a success. 70%, huge success. During the same period, the cost of operating the shuttle has also decreased by $1.25 billion annually, though I would also argue that it is partially because of the reusability of a lot of it. Like I said, the only thing you're really replacing is that main engine tank. So that kind of cuts cost, which is great, because then you can spend it on the missions, of course.
Yeah.
And at the same time, because of weight reductions and other improvements, the cargo and shuttle can carry increased by 7.3 metric tons, which is about 8 tons total. And of course, in managing the operating and safety of the space shuttle, NASA holds the safety crew as its highest priority. So all of that's great, but that's on the shuttle itself. So that's like the whole package. That's the orbiter, the tanks, the booster, etc. We'll talk a little bit about the individual parts because they do carry different payloads and expectations. So the orbiter, for example, that's where the crew hits. So you got to have a lot of extra things in there that you might not have in the rocket booster part. Go figure. So it has a height on the runway of that 57 feet, like we said, and that 122 feet in length and a 78 feet wingspan. It has, a mid-fuel fuselage and an aft fuselage. Don't ask me what that is. I don't know. And then it also has payload bay doors, which I'm assuming is how you move around, get in and out. I don't really know. Look at the diagram is what I would recommend.
That's fair.
The orbiter is both the brains and heart of the space transportation system, which if you heard what I called the crew previously, that STS, that's what it stands for. It's that space transportation system and then whatever number they're assigned. Mm-hmm. About the same size and weight as a DC-9 aircraft, the orbiter contains the pressurized crew compartment, which can normally carry up to that 7 crew member limit, and the huge cargo bay and the 3 main engines mounted on its aft end. So that's important. You need your engines.
Definitely.
The cockpit, living quarters, and experiment operator station are located in the forward fuselage of the orbiter vehicle, and payloads are carried in the mid area. And then the orbiter's main engines and maneuvering thrusters are located in the aft. And again, you can take a look at all of the different fuselages. There's the actual crew module, which is the actual station, which is a 3-section pressurized working living and stowage compartment in the front portion, which you obviously need for regular everyday stuff. And then the flight deck is usually designed for the pilot and co-pilot, which permits the vehicle to be piloted in either seat and permits 1-man emergency return, which is helpful. And each seat has manual flight controls, including rotation and translation hand controllers, rudder pedals, and speed brake controllers. So all the things you would need to actually fly this massive thing.
Yeah.
It does. I feel like every movie comments on the airlocks. It does have airlocks. My favorite part is when they're like, the airlock is broken, or if they're caught in the airlock, it's like, right. You know what I mean? Well, it's real. It's a real thing.
It's a real thing.
The airlock will provide access for spacewalks known as extravehicular activity, or EVA. I didn't even know there was a word for that.
Yeah.
It can be located in one of several places. Inside the orbiter crew module in the mid-deck area, mounted to the aft bulkhead. I don't know. I feel like I'm talking about a naval ship right now.
Yeah, honestly.
Outside the cabin, also mounted to the bulkhead or atop of a tunnel adapter that can be connected the pressurized space hab module with the orbiter cabin. And if you think I made all of that up, again, go click the link. So anyway,
it's true.
All of that.
I mean,
is the
you
orbiter.
Very well could have though. With all of that, you know.
How would they know?
How would you know exactly?
So that's all I'm going to talk about with the orbiter, because that's a lot of information and there's even more. So if you are interested in learning more about the different sections, feel free to do so.
Yes.
The second part of the shuttle itself is those main engines. There is three of them in conjunction with the solid rocket boosters, which are separate. And those provide that thrust and lift for the orbiter off of the ground for the initial ascent, because you obviously need a little punch in order to get into the air and then outside our atmosphere. The main engines continue to operate for about 8.5 minutes after the launch, the duration of the shuttle's powered flight, and after the solid rockets are jettisoned, the main engines will provide the actual thrust, which will accelerate the shuttle from 4,828 kilometers per hour in just 6 minutes to actually reach orbit. Wow. That's great time.
It's wonderful. No traffic.
No traffic. I mean, who's, you know, no in or out. You don't even have to worry about lanes, honestly.
Just going up.
Just going up. They do create a combined maximum thrust of more than 1.2 million pounds, which is incredible.
Wow.
And then as the shuttle accelerates, the main engines will burn 500,000 gallons of liquid propellant provided by that large external fuel tank that we talked about.
Uh-huh.
And then the main engines will burn liquid hydrogen, which makes Blair queasy, the second coldest liquid on Earth at minus 423 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yep. Still weirded out by that.
Oh, mm-hmm. Don't worry. There's liquid oxygen, too. We're going back to planets.
I don't like this.
That's fair. The engine's exhaust is primarily water vapor as the hydrogen and oxygen combine. So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Environment and stuff. And as they push the shuttle towards orbit, the engines will consume the liquid fuel at the rate that would drain an average family swimming pool in under 25 seconds and generating over 37 million horsepower.
That's nice. I'm sure that's great for the environment.
I will drain your pool. It's like the equivalent of don't make me turn this car around.
Don't make me turn this car around. Exactly.
The turbines on the thrusters spin almost three times as fast as an automobile engine spins when it's running at highway speed. So that's frightening. And then the main engines develop thrust by using high energy propellants in a staged combustion cycle. If you know what a combustion engine is, then you know how combustion cycles work. If you don't, Google it.
And you can join the club because neither do I.
we'll have another cars episode maybe. So each space shuttle main engine operates with that liquid oxygen hydrogen mixture, which is a ratio of 6 to 1 to produce the sea level thrust and a vacuum thrust. And apparently those are different. Look it up. I don't know the difference.
Apparently those are different.
Hey, I'm just telling you like I read it, okay? The engines can be throttled over a thrust range of 65% to 109%, which is that high level thrust during liftoff and the initial ascent, of course, because again, got to get through the clouds. And then the sentence that it provided for how this all turns out after launch is the engines are gimbaled to provide pitch, yaw, and roll control during the ascent. Is this like a rodeo in the sky?
What kind of language is that?
Space language, I suppose. I'm going to need the Air Force to translate or Space Force to translate because I don't know. Imagine. They'll just comment. Feel free. I don't know what it is, but that's what happens. Anyway, that's all I have at the beginning. And to me, that's kind of like the bare minimum have to know. The second part, we get to talk about the fun stuff, which is the rocket boosters, which is way more fun. And also, I do know that at this point, talking about all of the space exploration and space explorers that made the first launch, you're like, excuse me, you didn't mention someone yet. And if you don't know who that someone is, you'll find out in the second half.
Do you hate a quiet house?
Are you tired of listening to The Office in the background while doing the dishes?
Then you need mediocre content.
Listen to us giggle and rant about meaningless topics in the comfort of your own home.
Put us on in the background while cleaning your house, cooking, or even vacuuming.
We promise you won't miss anything important.
And you can always listen again.
Choose mediocre content for your background noise.
Welcome
back. So if you guys wanted to know.
Oh my God. Yes.
Got him. So if you guys want to know what a yaw is, it's actually a moving ship or aircraft.
Yes.
That it's twist or oscillate about a vertical axis.
Which sounds horrifying, by the way. Is this like a spinning rocket in the sky? I didn't research that. Can you imagine? You're just spiraling into the stratosphere like a football in the wind. I don't know.
There's a whole diagram on this page about like how aircraft move and everything, but we're not going to get into that right now because it's too confusing.
Just go Google it.
Especially because we're an audio medium, so it's like really hard to like explain that kind of thing without showing pictures.
It's true. They really, we should have just done streaming, you know? I'm just kidding. All the pictures. I wish there was a way when you post like a podcast to also include like, here's a diagram of what we talked about. Like instead of just a link, you know?
I feel like if we edited it. Yeah. that like on YouTube or whatever when we post the audio there, I think we could do it, but you know,
that's extra work. Okay,
a lot of work. Yeah.
Also, Chris is calling me right now, which is hilarious.
Oh my God, put him live on the pod.
Absolutely not. Oh, okay. He can wait.
All right.
Chris, if you're listening to this after the fact, yes, I saw that you called me at 4:17 at 1:22 p.m. I will call you back in the future.
That's right. She will.
Okay. Solid rocket boosters. This is the fun part because this is what actually propels you into space. And this is what everybody thinks about when they think about a rocket launch. They just think about the, you know, and that's what does this, right? So the solid rocket booster has a thrust at liftoff of over 2.6 million pounds, which is incredible. And yes, and the propellant properties include 16% atomized aluminum powder, which is fuel. There is 69.8% ammonium perchlorate. I'm gonna say perchlorate.
I think that's correct.
But anyway, that's an oxidizer. Then, of course, you need some kind of catalyst for the reaction to happen, which is 0.2% of iron oxide powder. There's a binder so that nothing gets loose and it's all safely contained together, and that is 12% of polybutadiene acrylic acid acrylonitrile, which is hard to say. And then there's a curing agent, which is the solidification of all the units together after the binder has done its job. This just contains it, and 2% epoxy curing agent. Lovely.
So would some say that that is rocket fuel, the components of rocket fuel?
I mean, some would say propellant might actually be rocket fuel. So yes.
So it's not Mountain Dew, like I previously thought.
That is battery acid, which you're referring to.
You're right.
It is a little bit different. Yeah.
You're correct. Yeah. That's true. Glad sorry we had this conversation.
Sorry if you like Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's great.
No, but that's the thing is I do like Mountain Dew. It's just that it's terrible for me.
It is.
It's not good for me.
But it's good, you know?
Yeah.
The Baja Blast is what I think about. It's perfect for spacecraft. Anyhoodle. So all of that propellant is quite heavy, or fuel, as Blair would say. And it weighs over 1.1 million pounds. Empty, if there was no fuel at all, we're talking about 193,000 pounds. So it has a gross weight, which is not yucky weight, it's just total, is over... disgusting. Is 1.3 pounds. 1.3 pounds, can you imagine? 1.3 million pounds, sorry.
It's lighter than a chihuahua.
You can hold it in the palm of your hand.
Your hand. No, wrong.
You cannot. There are also a lot of pieces and parts, of course, because you have to for safety reasons and to hold it together at high velocities with a lot of fire and heat and all of that. And that's not even just the fire and heat from the propulsion itself, but also getting into the stratosphere. So it's highly recommended that you check the link out, because I'm not going to go over all of that, and it's a lot of information and blah, blah, blah. So... Mm-hmm. The solid rocket boosters do operate in parallel with the main engines for the first 2 minutes of the flight, and that's that additional thrust. At an altitude of about 45 kilometers, which is 24 nautical miles, apparently you use nautical miles for the sky.
Apparently.
The boosters separate from the orbiter and the external tank, descend on little cute parachutes, and then land in the Atlantic Ocean somewhere, somehow, that we go and either retrieve or allow to just continue to decompose into the ocean. They say they're recovered by ships. I don't know if all of them are.
If you... Right.
let's be honest.
Because litter.
I'm just saying.
So... If you have ever watched any kind of rocket launching footage in any of your history classes...
Yes.
She just described the stuff that falls off.
Correct. Exactly.
So, yeah, because there's like the rocket and then there's like all the things around it that propel it. So,
yes.
Yeah, just so everyone has a visual kind of in a way.
That's exactly what it is. For the ones that they do recover, they are refurbished. So again, like I think that's the part that like it can't be reused as it is currently because it's just exploded into the atmosphere, basically. So...
Right.
Minor problem.
Mm-hmm.
So if they recover it, it's reused after refurbishing. The boosters can also assist in guiding the vehicle during the initial ascent, and thrust of both boosters is equal to about 5.3 million pounds. In addition to the solid rocket motor, the booster contains the structural, thrust vector control, separation, recovery, and electrical and instrumentation subsystems. For obvious reasons, they have to operate. And I'm not going to go into those either, because again, just take a look if you're interested in getting really into the grain of things. And if you're interested in what cured propellant looks like and feels like, so the propellant is used, it's, you know, burned and thrusts the thing up. And then cured propellant looks and feels like a hard rubber typewriter eraser. I don't know what a typewriter eraser is.
Yeah, we're too young for that.
But it's that. It's like hard rubber. And okay. The combined polymer and the curing agent is a synthetic rubber, of course. And flexibility of the propellant is controlled by the ratio of that binder and that curing agent we talked about with the solid ingredients, like the oxidizer. Mm. And the solid fuel is actually powdered aluminum, like we said. So that thing that you wrap your stuff, like the aluminum foil, in your kitchen, and then you mix it with with oxygen. Yeah,
say
you could
one
just
more
make
time for the people in the back.
Be quiet, Blair.
Aluminum foil.
Oil and foil are difficult for me. And mixed with the oxygen, provide a chemical called the ammonium perchlorate. You know what I'm talking about. It doesn't even matter. It's getting stuck in my mouth. It's what we talked about earlier.
Yes.
And so that is the rocket booster. Sounds like you could just make one up in your kitchen. So the external tank, also important. That's the second part of the actual thrusting of getting into the air for the orbiter and the shuttle in general. It weighs about 78,000 pounds. With the propellant, it has a yucky weight of 1.6 million pounds. Excuse
Gross
me.
Gross weight.
Disgusting. Just for funsies, it also made sure to let me know that liquid oxygen, which is in the propellant weight and volume, is 16 times heavier than liquid hydrogen. For some reason, it felt the need to tell me that. That's probably because it all weighs a lot. The external tank, or ET, not the one that phones home, is the gas tank for the orbiter. It contains the propellants used by the space shuttle main engines. The tank is also the backbone of the shuttle during the launch, providing that structural support for attachment with the solid rocket boosters and the orbiter. The tank is the only component of the space shuttle that is not completely reused, because it can't be. And approximately 8.5 minutes into the flight, with its propellant used, the tank is jettisoned. It's like, yeet, I'm out. And that's the whole
jettisoned is the old person way of saying yeeted.
Yeeted. We don't need you. When the solid rocket boosters separate at an altitude of approximately 45 kilometers, the orbiter with the main engine still burning carries the external tank piggyback, which is a cute way to say it, to the near orbital velocity of approximately 113 kilometers or 70 miles above the Earth. And that's fantastic. It disintegrates, and that's also what falls in the ocean. So you're seeing a lot of bits just coming off of there. Everyone's fine. It's all planned. It's shedding its skin. Okay.
I did see an article, and I don't know how true it was, but I did send it to you on Instagram about a lady and or some family in Florida had a piece of space debris fall through their house.
Oh, beautiful. As one
and
should.
As you are moving to Florida, I was like, how do we feel? Are we fangirling about this, or are we, because she loves space.
I
you
do.
Know, we know this about you.
I do. So,
but like also.
I would Florida. Be horrified at first. And the second part of me was like, I'm keeping this.
Yeah, right.
This is now mine.
It's no longer government property. It is nope. on my property. So that's, it is mine.
It fell from the sky. The sky is free game. And the backyard of my house is also mine.
Yeah.
All right. So all of that is the technical pieces. And that's lovely. But it really doesn't tell us much about the actual space exploration we've done with these colossal things, nor does it mention someone you probably still think I've forgotten, and I haven't. Don't worry. Hold your freaking boots on. We'll get there very shortly.
Just so the listener knows, I am unclear about who this person is as well.
Which
so
is
we're on this ride together.
You know what? That means you're not a real fan, you know?
I guess not.
You'll know as
but
soon
I
as I say it.
I definitely never claimed to be a fan. So here we are.
That's fair enough. Okay, so let's describe the crafts, what they've done, which ones are still with us, and which ones are sadly no longer with us. All right, the Orbiter Discovery, or OV-103, was NASA's third space shuttle orbiter to join the fleet. So these are kind of in like reverse order. Arriving for the first time at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, again in November 1983. After a checkout and processing, it was launched on August 30th, 1984 for the first mission, 41D, to deploy three communication satellites. Since that inaugural flight, Discovery has completed more than 30 successful missions, surpassing the number of flights made by any other orbiter in NASA's fleet, which is amazing. Just like all the other orbiters, it has undergone major modifications over the years. The most recent began in 2002 and was the first carried out at Kennedy Space Center. It provided 99 upgrades and 88 special tests, including new changes to make it safer in general for flight. The choice of the name Discovery carried on a tradition drawn from historic Earthbound exploring ships of the past. One of these sailing forerunners was the vessel used in the early 1600s by Henry Hudson to explore Hudson Bay and search for a Northwest Passage from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
The Pacific.
Words are hard, man.
Words are hard. You're doing a great job, though.
Doing my best. Okay, so that's the Discovery. Orbiter Endeavour, which is OV-105, authorized by Congress in 1987, was a replacement for the space shuttle orbiter Challenger and arrived at the Kennedy Space Center shuttle landing facility May 7, 1991. And this was piggybacked on top of NASA's new space shuttle carrier aircraft, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time, an orbiter was named through a national competition, which involved students in elementary and secondary schools. They were asked to select a name based upon an exploratory or research sea vessel, which is, again, just where the tradition comes from.
Yep.
And in May 1989, President George Bush announced the winning name. Endeavour was named after a ship chartered to traverse the South Pacific in 1768 and captained by 18th century British explorer James Cook, an experienced seaman, navigator, and amateur astronomer.
Wow.
He commanded a crew of 93 men, including 11 scientists and artists, and Cook's main objective at the time was tasked by the British Admiralty and the Royal Society to observe the transit of Venus at Tahiti, which is pretty cool, actually.
Mm-hmm.
This reading enabled astronomers to find the distance of the sun from the Earth, which then could be used as a unit of measurement in calculating the parameters of the universe. So that little trip gave us a lot of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fitting name, honestly. We then have Orbiter Atlantis, or OV-104. This was the fourth space-rated space shuttle and was named after the two masted boats that served as the primary research vessel for the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts from 1930 to 1966. The boat, I know, right? The boat had a 17-member crew and accommodated up to 5 scientists who worked in the 2 onboard laboratories examining water samples and marine life, which sounds like a lot of fun. The crew also used the first electronic sounding devices to map the ocean floor, also huge.
Mm-hmm.
And construction of the Orbiter Atlantis began on March 3rd, 1980. Thanks to the lessons learned in the construction and testing of orbiters like Enterprise, Columbia, and Challenger, Atlantis was completed in about half the time and man-hours spent on the Columbia. This is largely attributed to the use of large thermal protection blankets on the orbiter's upper body rather than individual tiles that required more attention. Weighing in at 151,000 pounds when it rolled all out of the assembly plant in Palmdale, California, Atlantis was nearly 3.5 tons lighter than Columbia, which is also big. If you just to kind of put it in perspective, I guess, if it's lighter, as a vessel, number one, it means that you have more ability to add additional cargo, additional crew members, or other pieces that make it more comfortable to ride. But it also requires less things like propellant because you're not as heavy. It doesn't take as much to get you up.
True.
So just kind of wanted to say, you know, why that's important. The new orbiter arrived at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida on that April 9, 1985 date, and over the next 7 months was prepared for her maiden voyage. In recent years, Atlantis has delivered several vital components to the International Space Station, including the U.S. laboratory module, Destiny, as well as the Joint Airlock Quest, the airlock, and multiple sections of the integrated truss structure that makes up the station's backbone, which are kind of vital.
Yes.
Just minor things. I think this is kind of where things get sad. So just kind of strap in a little bit on this one.
Okay, everyone get out your tissues.
I know, it's not great. So Orbiter Challenger, or OV-099, was first called STA-099 and was built to serve as a test vehicle for the space shuttle program. But despite its Earthbound beginnings, STA-099 was destined for space. And in the late 1970s, NASA strived for a lighter weight orbiter, but a test vehicle was needed to ensure that it could handle the stress of spaceflight, because that's the biggest question, right?
Right.
So computer software at the time wasn't really advanced enough to accurately predict how it would optimize the design would need to be in response to the intense heat and stress of exiting the stratosphere and then having to come back. The best solution was to submit the vehicle to a year of intensive vibration and thermal testing. And Space Shuttle Orbiter Challenger was named after the British naval research vessel HMS Challenger that sailed the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans during the 1870s. The Apollo 17 lunar module also carried the name of Challenger. Like its historic predecessors, Challenger and her crews made significant scientific contributions in the spirit of exploration. Challenger launched on her maiden voyage, STS-6, on April 4, 1983. That mission would see the first spacewalk of the space shuttle program, as well as the deployment of the first satellite in the tracking and data relay system constellation. The orbiter launched the first American woman, Sally Ride, into space on mission STS-7.
and was the first to carry two U.S. female astronauts on mission STS-41G. Now, Challenger's service to America's space program ended tragically January 28, 1986, just 73 seconds into mission, STS-51L, a booster failure caused an explosion that would result in the loss of seven astronauts as well as the entire vehicle. So, super sad, super traumatic, but it also had great strides prior to the accident as well.
Yeah.
The second sad part is related to orbiter Columbia, or OV-102. April 12, 1981, a bright white Columbia roared into a deep blue sky at the nation's first reusable space shuttle. So this was the very first entry into this market, very first view for the people as well. So this was a big deal for, you know, a lot of people. They got to see this, I think, up close and personal, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a lot of old news stories about it, which is always fun to look back on. So feel free to dive in to that. But anyway, it was named after the first American ocean vessel to circle the globe and the command module for the Apollo 11 moon landing. Mm-hmm. Columbia continued this heritage of intrepid exploration. The heaviest of NASA's orbiters, Columbia weighed too much and lacked the necessary equipment to assist with assembly of the International Space Station. Mm-hmm. Despite its limitations, the orbiter's legacy is one of groundbreaking scientific research and notable firsts in space flight. Space shuttle mission STS-9, launched in late November 1983, was the maiden flight for Space Lab. Designed to be a space-based scientific lab, Space Lab was installed inside the orbiter's cargo bay. Space Lab featured an enclosed crew work module connected to an outside payload pallet, which could be mounted with various instruments and experiments. From inside the lab, astronauts worked with the experiments on the pallet and within the crew module itself. The lab would go on to fly aboard the rest of the fleet, playing host throughout its accomplished lifetime to unprecedented research in astronomy, biology, and other sciences. Space Lab ultimately finished where its career began. Its 16th and final mission was hoisted into space aboard Columbia in 1998. Columbia and its crew were tragically lost during STS-107 in 2003. As the space shuttle lifted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on January 16, a small portion of foam broke away from the orange external fuel tank and struck the orbiter's left wing. Not great. Mm-hmm. The resulting damage created a hole in the wing's leading engine, which caused the vehicle to break apart during re-entry to Earth's atmosphere on February 1. Ooh. So sad again.
Yeah.
But lots of scientific breakthroughs. Also, with Columbia being the heaviest, this was also the start of a lot of the innovations and adjustments they made to the modern ones. And like I said at the beginning, NASA's number one thing is being safe while doing all of this. And they really do try their best to do it. Like I said, they have diagrams and information and all that stuff about it. So highly recommend giving it a look. So now on for this mystery person that I don't even know if you know who I'm talking about. So we've talked about the first people with the shuttle moon landing and the first people with the space exploration and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, excuse me. There is one person who I know was the first person to walk on the frickin' moon. And you're going to sit here and tell me that this shuttle man was first? Calm down, first of all. Neil Armstrong is the person I'm referring to. And the reason that I don't bring him up, especially when we're talking about the first shuttle moonwalk, is because Neil Armstrong was not on a space shuttle. Talking about space shuttles is different because July 21, 1969, Neil Armstrong became the first person to step out onto the moon in general. He was joined, of course, by Aldrin 19 minutes later,
And the two spent about 2 hours walking around the lunar module, taking the photos, collecting lunar rocks and stuff to be tested, and blah, blah, blah. The video recording of his moonwalk was transmitted to Mission Control in Houston, of course, and watched by everyone that had a television. And Armstrong became a member of NASA when he was established on 1 October 1958, and he was selected for Project Gemini, which was NASA's second human spaceflight program, on 17 September 1962. It, of course, paved the way for Apollo 11 to go to the moon. However, traveling to the moon and returning required three unique technologically advanced pieces of spacecraft that were different than what we just talked about. Saturn V, which is what they were using to do these missions, was a rocket, which is not the same. That rocket is the first thing we talked about in the beginning, where you shoot it up and the only thing that survives is the top capsule where the astronauts are. That gets thrown into space and returns. The rest of it is obliterated and you never see it again because you can't reuse it.
Right.
So that's why it's a little bit different. The Saturn V rocket, the command module and the lunar module, of those, they have specific names, Columbia, ironically, and Eagle for the lunar module. Mm-hmm. All of these make up what you know as the Neil Armstrong rocket. So the command module Columbia, the Apollo 11 command module Columbia carried astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin and Michael Collins on the first historic voyage to the moon. And during the journey, Columbia, its interior space was about as roomy as a large automobile for reference, served as their main quarters. So that is what they were in when they went out into space.
Right.
The lunar module Eagle used for descent to the lunar surface and served as the base while the astronauts were on the moon physically. A separate ascent stage comprising the top portion of the lunar module lifts the astronauts from the moon's surface to rendezvous and dock with the command module that's orbiting the moon. Because lunar modules were designed to fly only in the vacuum of space, they do not have to be streamlined like aircraft, nor carry a heat shield for protection during reentry. And then Saturn V, which was the manned Apollo missions launched aboard Saturn V as the launch vehicle. The V comes from the five F1 engines that powered the first stage of the rocket, so at the ascent. And almost five decades later, the Saturn V remains the United States' largest and most powerful launch vehicle that has ever been built. So what you really need to know that Neil Armstrong, the only thing that's different and the only reason we didn't mention him with all of these firsts and these missions and the moons and the blah, 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 is just because he didn't do it in the space shuttle. That's literally all.
Right.
It's, you know, it's just because he was in the rocket. It was a one-time situation. You launch it up, you do your thing, and then you come back. And the reason that it's important is because the shuttle system, like we've talked about, really introduced this idea of recycling and being able to modify these vehicles so that they were safer, more environmentally friendly to the best of our abilities, and still significantly more roomy and spacious for the actual missions.
Yeah. And and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that like the rocket thing is like what Jeffrey Bezos is doing and like all the billionaires are doing. They're not doing space shuttles. They're just doing the rockets for like consumer trips. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like it's not like the space shuttle.
I believe thing. That is correct. Yes.
Yeah.
For multiple reasons, a rocket, I say cheaper lightly, right? But we just talked about all the different parts a space shuttle needs and all the different components and propellant and how heavy this thing is. Compared to a rocket, you know, a rocket is, quote, easier to build financially, structurally, with all the knowledge that you need of all the different components and how they fit together. You don't just have to worry about exit, you have to worry about full re-entry for almost 90% of the parts on a space shuttle. And a rocket, you have to make sure that it can get out there and only one part has to return. Right. So it's just, you know, I just wanted to make sure I mentioned it because I know that he's obviously very famous for very good reasons. Don't get me wrong. However, I would also like to say that there are other advancements that have been made and other amazing astronauts out there that have done significantly wonderful things for the community that did it on something that was new and exciting and safer to a point.
Yep. Yep.
So I just wanted to make sure I mention him because I feel like if you don't, people will be upset. So I just wanted to say something about it. It's not enough to have an entire segment on space rockets, really. I mean, we could, but it's not going to have nearly as much information because it was, you know, a smaller time frame, I believe. Yep. So anyway, that's all I have on space rockets and space shuttles and people in space, I guess. Cats in space or something. I don't know.
Feel free to send us an email with any questions, comments, concerns, or episode topic suggestions at mediocrecontentpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram, TikTok, or Twitch at Mediocre Content Podcast. We stream on Twitch every other Thursday at 3 p.m. PST, 6 p.m. EST, or 11 p.m. BST. And don't forget to rate us 5 stars anywhere you listen to podcasts. That includes Apple Podcasts, Spotify,
Pandora.
It's not Flickr.
That's a photography thing.
It's
one of those.
Whatever the other ones are. Amazon Music.
Amazon. Yeah, there you go.
Amazon Podcasts, whatever they have. yeah, and we'll see you next week. Thanks so much for listening. This has been Mediocre Content.
Thanks so much for listening. Cheers.
Cheers.